Okay, I think we can get started. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Deepa Malapalli, and I'm the Associate Director of the Seeger Center for Asian Studies. It's good to see so many of you here for this talk. We don't have that many events on Southeast Asia, and we're very happy today to have someone from Southeast Asia speaking about the U.S. rebalance to Asia, the pivot, whatever you want to call it. This topic is particularly of import to Seeger Center because under the Rising Powers Initiative, which I also direct, we have had a series of policy reports looking at the reactions from different major countries in Asia to the U.S. rebalance. So China's response, Japan's response, India's response. And I think we're really rounding out project by having a talk today on the ASEAN response. The title of our earlier report that came out a month ago was called Balancing Acts, the Asia's response to the U.S. rebalance. And I think it captures very well perhaps today what our speaker is going to do as well, because the rebalance has raised a very thorny question for the region, and that is how do you have that delicate balancing act between, of course, a rising China and then the U.S. And in fact, I was just told by Julio Amador, who's our speaker today, that he will be delivering a talk soon at the East-West Center, where he is a visiting scholar, on the ASEAN, how ASEAN is going to deal with the China-U.S.-ASEAN factor, whereas today it's the U.S. factor that he's going to be looking at. So there are different angles to this question that's going to keep coming up. But now, I have the privilege of introducing Mr. Amador, who is currently with the East-West Center in Washington here. He is, however, on leave as a foreign affairs research specialist at the Foreign Service Institute in Manila. He has been very key in providing analysis and advice on ASEAN issues, on Southeast Asian security and Asian security in general, to many of the departments in the Foreign Office in Manila, to the Philippines. He has had visiting scholarships at various places, including San Diego, UC San Diego, as well as a Fulbright Scholar at the Maxwell School of Citizenship and Public Affairs in Syracuse. He has also published extensively in journals, book chapters, and so on, and he's a frequent commentator in the media. And I think he's going to be giving us, a broad overview and several provocative statements that we, I'm sure, can discuss during the Q&A after his talk. And may I also remind you that we have given out this questionnaire, a survey that would be very useful for us, that we would really appreciate you all taking just 2 minutes to fill this out before you leave today. So with that, I invite the speaker, Mr. Amador.
Thank you, and good afternoon to everyone. Before I begin my talk, let me just express my appreciation to the Seeger Center and to Dr. McCord and Dr. Olapalli, and to Mike Beaufort, who reached out to me when I first arrived in DC to give a talk. So this was planned in June, and so this is a bit of a long time coming. And I did have some notes, so please forgive me if I glance from time to time. The problem with an extrovert becoming a public commentator is that scares the heck out of me when I speak. So please forgive me on that. And I'm going to talk on the rebalance, and specifically it's a view from Southeast Asia, especially ASEAN. And I've designed it to be broad, so you'd feel free to ask questions later on topics that might fall under this. As you may know, sometimes you talk about the U.S. rebalance and Southeast Asia and ASEAN, and then someone always asks the question, what about China? So please, if you want to ask that question later, feel free to do so. Now, as many of you No doubt. No, ASEAN was founded in 1967 in the midst of internal turmoil caused by various domestic insurgencies within this, the founding member states. Regional or external stability was necessary so that national leaders could focus on solving their domestic issues. Now, over the years, ASEAN has expanded to the current 10-member association and has been credited with stabilizing the Southeast Asian region. And there's evidence of some success because we have an absence of open conflict between its members during its more than 40 years of existence. And there are now, this is an overview of where ASEAN is. There used to be a question about whether Southeast Asia is equal to ASEAN, and people answer this is not the case, and I believe this is not necessary. But as there's always an issue about whether there's an ASEAN region or a Southeast Asian region, and there are questions of identity that are embedded in those questions. But as you can see, it covers a huge area. It's over half the size of the continental United States, and we have about 600 million people, and we have a young population, so this is going to increase in the coming years. So it's also the third largest Asian trading partner of the US after China and Japan. And we have this website called Asia Matters for America at the East West Center in Washington website, so we are able to provide some of this data there for you. Now, you have ASEAN's importance, especially because the region is very strategic. It is, of course, one of the main avenues for trade, especially the Strait of Malacca, and then you have this Lombok Strait, where about two-thirds of the world's global and energy trade pass through that. Also because the sea lines of communication are very important to many countries in East Asia, including the US, because it connects both the Indian Ocean to the and the Pacific Ocean. So for many countries which have an interest in freedom of navigation, ASEAN's role and ASEAN's presence is important. Economic potential, it has a very big potential to rise. Especially because as we are coming with the ASEAN Economic Community in 2015, we are seeing more integration, especially in trade and economic issues. Now, this is just a picture that we came up in the East-West Center. We updated some illustration of ASEAN, what I call Asia-Pacific multilateralism. ASEAN established several mechanisms such as the ASEAN Plus 3, the ASEAN Plus 6, or what is now known as the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, the East Asian Summit, the ASEAN Regional Forum, and the ASEAN Defense Ministers Meeting. But as you can see from this illustration, the depth, the width and depth of multilateral institutions in the region is just so huge. I mean, sometimes those of us who have been observing this, especially in the foreign ministries, confuse ourselves what's happening where and what. So sooner or later, if you work on ASEAN, you have to be familiar with what is APT or ASEAN Plus 3, RCEP, ARF, SCO, TPP, all of these things, and ASEAN, of course. So we have a propensity for alphabet soups, and this is just how complicated the issue is. There are trade issues embedded in many of these groupings. There are security issues. There are functional cooperative area issues such as science and cooperation in science and technology, climate change, labor and migration, and all of these things. So at the end of it, the question is, what has been achieved? And this is always the question that many of us have to answer year in, year out, so that we can come up with our reports. So, in 2015, ASEAN is expected to realize what it terms the ASEAN community. For the first part, it's going to be the ASEAN Economic Community, and which envisions ever closer cooperation in the implementation of the blueprints that will help ASEAN integrate more, including, of course, narrowing the development gap between those ASEAN economies which are, in a sense, stronger and those that are less developed. It is, I would argue, one of the main contributors to the Asian century because of its economic vitality and its strategic importance. And I think this is part of the reason for the U.S. rebalance. And within that rebalance, there is a rebalance to Southeast Asia. As you may know, the rebalance has been following six lines, including, among others, the strengthening of bilateral security alliances, deepening working relations with emerging powers, engaging regional multilateral institutions, and expanding trade and investment, forging a broad-based military presence, and the advancing of democracy and human rights. So this is how the U.S. has been selling, projecting the rebalance to everyone. And in some sense, many Asian states buy into some of that, but not necessarily all. But this rebalance, along with China's rise, affects one of ASEAN's dearly held goal or dearly held claim that it is central to all of this, to the regional security architecture or even the broader regional architecture. So the rebalance challenges ASEAN because ASEAN is a conglomeration of weak or middle powers, but then you have these major powers such as a lone superpower, and then a rising power and several other powers in the region, all competing for influence. Now, initially ASEAN, because of its non-threatening situation, non-threatening function, ASEAN was accepted as the driver of regionalism. But with the rebalance coming in and with pressure coming from major countries for ASEAN to inevitably take sides, that centrality is being challenged. Now, ASEAN's dilemma is trying to find a balance between member states' dependency on the great powers while trying to maintain autonomy. So we can say that the formation of regional organizations or regional mechanisms is the common expression or the common predicament of lesser powers who want to remain independent of more powerful states. In other words, the formation of regional groupings, the subsequent strengthening of regional norms, and a unified approach to engaging other states are reactions to the possibility of being dominated by a great power intent on pushing its agenda, whether that great power is the superpower or the rising power within the region. Now, ASEAN seeks acceptance of its concept of regional order to avoid being dominated, for example, by China's emphasis on power balancing and preference for great power cooperation. At the same time, ASEAN wants to engage the US and accept its supremacy while trying to keep liberal values at bay, if it could. So the relationship between lesser powers such as ASEAN and great powers, especially with the US, can never be one of equals. But it is a mutually reinforcing hierarchical system premised on deference in return for security and economic goods, self-restraint, and credible demonstrations of benignity. So there have always been questions about why is the U.S. known as the security guarantor of Southeast Asia? Why is it that Southeast Asia seems to be open to U.S. leadership but not to other great power leadership? It's not only because the U.S. has two treaty allies, Thailand and the Philippines, and a strategic partner in Singapore. It's also because of this. They know that the U.S. is not going to grab any of their territories. They know that the U.S., while negotiating hard on trade issues, will not close its markets to Southeast Asia in the event of, you know, opposing views or opposing stand on several issues, as well as the promise of self-restraint if things come to a show. Like, we don't expect the U.S. to be invading a Southeast Asian country anytime soon. There's no fear of that. So, I would argue that this regional order is a negotiated hierarchy. While this order accepts that great powers are inevitably going to flex power and demand some sort of acknowledgement, and here I'm talking not only about the US, but China, India, and all of those powers that want to play a role in the region. So lesser powers such as member states of ASEAN, under careful norm building and diplomatic activities, can escape being overwhelmed, but still be able to drive the regional agenda. As Evelyn Goh puts it, the stability of a hierarchical order is fundamentally related to a collective sense of uncertainty about the leadership and order of the hierarchy. So what is the future of US-ASEAN relations under the rebalance? For ASEAN, the rebalancing is critical to its preferred regional order. U.S. primacy is a stabilizing factor because it is seen as neutral in terms of not having any territorial ambitions, its benignity, and its importance in managing flashpoints such as the Korean Peninsula and the Taiwan Straits. The U.S. declared national interest in freedom of navigation can be interpreted as ensuring that the South China Sea can never be purely an East Asian affair, but one that involves the dominant power in ASEAN's accepted hierarchy. But I would argue also that U.S. foreign policy could use more consistency with regard to the message that it sends to Asia. This is particularly crucial to our friends in the State Department, which has an enviable task of making assurances to its multiple allies and partners in the region. So when in Asia, talk Asia should be commonsensical. So when in Asia, please, the meeting should be first with an Asian leader, not a European leader. It should be commonsensical for senior government leaders from the US. But for now, it is actually US presence in major ASEAN diplomatic meetings that is highly needed, for the contest for leadership in the region is primarily about the message that the great power brings, as well as the credibility of that message. However, let me emphasize that even if the US slips from its role as the dominant power in East Asia, it doesn't mean automatically that primacy will be given to the second power in that hierarchy. Rather, I expect two scenarios. We should expect each ASEAN member state to strengthen ties with other powers, including India, Japan, Australia, South Korea, and even the European Union, so that they could provide them some aid during times of potential confrontation, not only in the security sphere, but also in the economic sphere. And the second situation that I would expect is an arms race as a means of deterrence. And this has been a regional, in some regional meetings that I've attended or some experts that I've talked to, they fear that if the U.S. loses its primacy, or the U.S. again reneges from its rebalance, the region will engage in an arms race, which is problematic because there are development issues that could be sidetracked if the region instead focuses on improving their security and defense capabilities. So both of these scenarios are not particularly pleasing to me, but I think logically this would be the course, the outcome, if the great powers, if the situation comes to a point where the great power, there's a major change in great power relations that affects Southeast Asia. So to sum it up, this is how it is in the region. So that ends my presentation, and I'd be happy to accept your questions.
Okay, we have quite a bit of time for Q&A, so let me just open it up to the floor now, and please identify yourself and wait for the mic.
Hello, my name is Paul Rodas from the American Development Bank. I have three quick questions. One is about regional integration of ASEAN. Always the rhetoric of integration is higher than the real achievements. You will need to point out two or three major achievements of ASEAN. Which would be those two or three major achievements? The second, China is not a member of ASEAN, but it has been said in the last years that it has a kind of veto power, veto power through Cambodia and Laos. And then you see this as a risk that ASEAN is not going to progress more because despite Thailand, Vietnam, and some other countries want to push some initiatives, China is blocking some of this. And just the last one, quickly, you talk about the Mekong River, because China is the upper country in the Mekong, it has been said that it has a strong influence in what can happen with the Mekong River in all the other countries. That even if sometimes this is not going to happen, and of course, but it has been speculated, it can even change the route of the Mekong River, or at least take most of the water and leave with scarce water to the
down
river countries. Please, three questions. Thank you.
Three questions.
Normally, I wouldn't have allowed three, but since we have so much time for discussion, I let it go.
Yeah. Well, That's always been the case of, you know, having very very high sounding aspirational documents such as your blueprints and your charter, and then the question is, what about the results, right? And RASIAN's results in many ways are modest, but there have been some consistent results. One of the problems pointed out about economic integration is that the problem is not actually within ASEAN, it's within the national boundaries, because this is where the issue of an ASEAN policy separate from national policy. And we always say that Southeast Asia, those of us who have been observing ASEAN, is different from ASEAN itself, because you might come to a regional agreement at the that level, but the implementation is at the national level, and how national policies are going to be adjusted to that is still an issue. But there have been some achievements, including, among others, increased cooperation between ASEAN and its neighboring countries. In fact, ASEAN plus three, ASEAN plus China, Japan, and South Korea have been engaging in major economic relations for some time, including, of course, further lowering of what remains to be seen, I would think, of tariff rates and all that. But there's also the establishment of the Chiang Mai Initiative for multilateral mechanism for debt-related issues, which was a product of the 1997 Asian financial crisis. And the fact that within ASEAN itself, ASEAN citizens of member states can travel almost anywhere without the need for a visa. We've removed several visa restrictions, especially for visiting other countries. It's a big achievement. And you have a boom of cheap travel flights that has allowed many people in the region to actually visit one another. This was not possible several years ago, but it is now one of those things that have been booming as part of ASEAN's leadership. Now, as to China's supposed veto power, well, it really, I would say that there's no direct veto, but it's also product of how major powers are able to convince their allies or partners within ASEAN to do what they want. And I think it's normal, right? Even the US exercises the same, or tries to exercise the same influence over ASEAN member states that it is agreeable with. And so what would be India, would Australia, and Japan. So this is not necessarily the case where only one country has that kind of veto. But in the case of Cambodia, during last year's ASEAN ministerial meeting, where you have for the first time ever, you didn't have a declaration or the joint communique, everyone in the region really felt China's hand. And this is why Brunei and Indonesia did their best to repair the damage. So under Brunei's leadership, we have seen the return of the issue of the South China Sea territorial disputes in the joint communique, although in a very as a watered down form. And Indonesia did attempt regional leadership to try to salvage the effect of, or to try to save the association from what happened in Phnom Penh. Now, to the lower Mekong issue, I'm not deeply familiar with that. I've not been focusing sub-regional issues that much, so I wouldn't be able to give an answer.
Okay. Other part, right here. Mike over here.
Hi, I'm Edmund Sim. I'm a law professor at National University of Singapore, and I teach ASEAN Economic Community Law and Policy as a course. Two very quick questions. One, how do you, first of all, in the last summit, there was a call for a high-level task force to improve and reform the ASEAN institutions themselves, which I noticed that you went through the entire talk without mentioning the ASEAN Secretary General, the ASEAN Secretariat. And so, can you give some views from your point of view about how we could strengthen the institutions? Second question goes to a fundamental frustration that those of us who teach economic policy of ASEAN have, and that is the countries that want the most U.S. involvement in the region, i.e. the Philippines and Indonesia, are also the ones which are least capable of entering into the TPP talks. And I get this over and over again from both sides. And so the question is, how do you square the circle? Because basically the TPP is all we're offering right now. We can barely get that through our own Congress. So my question is, if this is all we have to offer, and yet the people who want closer ties and the rebalancing on the economic side are incapable or unwilling to join the TPP talks, then what are we supposed to do? Because right now, otherwise, you know, because the Americans always get accused of saying the rebalancing is a political security exercise. But it's also supposed to be an economic exercise. But if our only tool is something that's unacceptable to three of the major middle powers in ASEAN, what are we supposed to do?
Those are very good questions indeed. On the ASEAN Secretariat Asia, there's always been a question of whether the Secretary General is more secretary than general, right? Or whether it should be general than secretary. And in the sense that you have a very secretariat that cannot actually compel member states to even submit reports is problematic. And there have been talks about reforming ASEAN, but you can see there's this tension between giving more powers to the secretariat and actually maintaining control over it. So no one has been able to actually categorically declare within ASEAN that they want the secretariat to have to exercise more initiative. Even initiative, not even compel, but just to come up with, say, with certain things, because each member state wants to have its own agenda, especially year after year. So you could even argue that every year, the state or the entity that you should look into is the chair of ASEAN, not the ASEAN Secretariat, because it is the chair that determines primarily the agenda for that year. For next year, it's going to be Myanmar's turn, so everyone's watching out how Myanmar's going to go about this thing. But you're right, the question of strengthening the secretariat has been at the forefront of everyone's mind. And one of the funny things that reached me when I was still in the Foreign Service Institute, and I'd like to say that my comments right now do not reflect any official stance, was how do you provide more funds to the ASEAN Secretariat without an exchange for greater influence? It's like everyone shares the same level of funding for the ASEAN Secretariat, independent of one's capacity to actually provide more. Because if we say we allow Singapore or Indonesia to give more funds to the ASEAN Secretariat, would it dilute the influence of other countries? So for everyone's sake, we say let's keep it at the very minimum level, you know, the most that we can spare. And of course, that doesn't get you far.
But that's why the Americans fund the secretary.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, not all that.
Well,
but
almost.
Well, that's still also questionable. But in the sense that ASEAN also has a problem of absorbing these funds. If these funds are coursed to the ASEAN Secretariat, one of the main problems is how to get member states to actually use them. So recently, they've been trying to come up with, you know, with initiatives to for member states to apply for this funding to use them, because this funding have been, these funds have been collecting interest because nobody knows in the first place how to access them. So we said, we declare that there's an ASEAN-Japan fund. Then the question is, how do we get them? So it just sits there. I mean, that's been happening for several years now. And even though there have been some changes because some people have been looking at it for some projects, it's still not that big of a factor for many member states. And the problem also is the amount of money there. It's not that big as compared to what member states can get through bilateral partnerships. Now, as to that, so there has to be some fundamental reforms that ASEAN has to reflect on, especially with the Secretariat, and I agree with that. Without thinking or without reflecting on what the role of the Secretariat will be, I think this is not going to be, I mean, the ASEAN regional project is going to be hobbled to that extent. But at the same time, how to balance it to make sure that you don't cede too much power to Jakarta? In that sense that people are now complaining to the European Union about too much power in Brussels. That's always been the fear of ASEAN member states. Now, to the question of the TPP, that is a fair point, I think, that, you know, the two countries or the countries, many of the countries that have been asking the U.S. to become more involved in the region are not in fact ready to join the TPP. And I think this was acknowledged, especially in the Philippines, that, you know, there are some institutional reforms, especially in our investment rules, that we should undertake, especially on ownership of land and property. otherwise we'd not be able to even knock on the door of the TPP. But then, this is the beauty of the rebalance. I would think that it has many components upon which member states can draw on if they feel the need to get the US involved. So for the Philippines right now, it's really about deepening diplomatic and security cooperation. In this case, you have the current negotiations on an expanded framework for US access to Philippine military facilities. So it really depends what on the priorities of each ASEAN member state and what the US can give and where they can align themselves with. But on the TPP point, I think it's a fair point to raise on the capacity of many ASEAN countries, in fact, to actually participate in the negotiations.
Actually, I'm going to jump in with a question that's very related to the TPP, if I may. I see two tracks of economic integration going on right now in Asia. One is the TPP, the other is the RCEP. And so that raises a question because one of them, the TPP does not include China, and it's a US-led effort, whereas the RCEP has got China, it has the major countries in the region, and it's a more regional effort. Is there a tension between those two, that ASEAN, how does ASEAN see that, and how do they see their role in either promoting one or the other, and their actual participation in a strong way? How are they balancing that?
That's a good question. And just to give you a background on the RCEP, before it became the RCEP, within the East Asian region, there was in fact a conflict as to what kind of free trade agreement or economic agreement should prevail on a regional basis. We had an ASEAN Plus 3 initiative which was spearheaded by China, which was really the East Asia Free Trade Area, or it covers the ASEAN Plus 3. And of course, many ASEAN member states felt that, you know, ASEAN Plus 3 is a good area for mechanism for cooperation, but nobody wants to be trapped in the same room with the largest economic power in the East Asian region. Japan offered an alternative. You have the Comprehensive Economic Partnership for East Asia, or the CEPEA, where basically it's the ASEAN Plus 3 plus 6, including Japan, including Australia, India, and New Zealand. And now that was eventually the idea. I mean, in terms of form, it was what was adopted. The ASEAN Plus 6 became the modality, and now you have the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership Agreement. But the problem then for ASEAN was that they didn't want to run on the script under CEPEA because of some issues that they have. So, and they also didn't want to copy IAFTA because they didn't want to be seen as following Chinese leadership in that regard. So they said, let's come to a certain agreement, that this RCEP, which is what one would argue would be, in fact, some observers have said it would be shallower but wider in scope. I mean, the commitments are not that deep. They are primarily negotiable, but then other states can come in the future. Now, as opposed to the TPP, which is very exclusive in that regard because it is a high-level agreement, there are feelings in Southeast Asia that it can be a dividing issue because it does divide ASEAN member states as to what countries can participate in the TPP and what countries cannot. And I think, as with ASEAN, we try to get the best of both worlds. If we can, we will try to find our way so that we can join the TPP. But if not, the RCEP is there. There's always this thing about, you know, these are not conflicting positions. You can actually have them side by side. Now, how that will turn out is still something that everyone's looking at because there are some issues with the TPP itself, especially if the U.S. cannot itself assure us that the TPP will pass Congress, then what will be the progress of TPP? Then RCEP, for all of its flaws, becomes the next best option.
Okay, thank you. Others? There was a question over there. Let's go to that side.
My name is Zubhanshu. I'm from India. And I have two quick questions. One, do you think could ASEAN have dealt with the Phnom Penh crisis in a better way than it did, one? And second, some of the individual member states of ASEAN is also engaging in bilateral a defense consolidation through security alliances. For example, the Philippines through the US, and also engaging in defense procurement from Japan as well. How does that reflect on ASEAN as a united front? Thank you.
Does not reflect well. That's the short answer. But it does raise several points that I think should be addressed. Now, on the Phnom Penh issue, this is where the problem of having, you know, this is an institutional problem. When ASEAN allowed member states, those new member states to come in and gave them the same rights as the founding members, everything just, you know, just went in a very slow trajectory. And sorry, this is why I cannot be a diplomat, I've been very blunt. So this is what happened, right? You have the original ASEAN member states were committed to several goals, in fact. They were moving forward at a pace that was actually acceptable because they had converging interests, which allowed them to agree on many things. But then you have several new member states coming in, and then they were given the same rights. Basically, it boils down to a veto power. When one member state says no, then the region doesn't move forward. So that's a big problem. And this is what happened when we gave Phnom Penh, or when Phnom Penh was chairing, because it had the leverage over how the communique was going to be drafted. So there were these stories about, you know, having a draft communique, and then someone was actually vetting it in the next room. And, you know, you can have your sources and that. But it's that one. ASEAN should have handled it. It's not could have handled it, should have handled it better. And I think many ASEAN member states felt afterwards that when they allowed the process to move forward without issuing a joint communique, there was a very big blow to ASEAN's reputation. So that's why Foreign Minister Martina Tagaligawa had to undertake a shuttle diplomacy around the region to repair some of these damages. And I was still with the Institute that time, and there were some frustrations among the Philippine foreign policymakers because Vietnam and the Philippines were actually willing to tone down or at least soften the wording that they wanted to include in the joint communique. But then our friends from Phnom Penh just said no, and you know, when that's the kind of benchmark that you have for negotiation, then there's no such thing as negotiations anymore. So that was a big blow, and everyone realized that. That's why when Brunei came in, it had to reverse the impact of what happened in Phnom Penh. Now, this is a very good question on strategic partnerships, which I've been very interested in. I'm actually writing a paper on it. There is a rise of what we call strategic partnerships in East Asia. These are not necessarily security alliance and the level of what the US has with the Philippines and Thailand. But you know, every country has been going around the region declaring that they have found a strategic partner in this and that major power. And in some cases, this actually raises alarm because everyone's going his or her own way. And this, so the Philippines has signed a strategic partnership agreement with Japan. India has one with Vietnam. Indonesia has one with China, I think, which was only declared few weeks back. So, you know, it creates a certain web where, you know, everyone's enmeshed in some sort of commitment. But the thing about the strategic partnerships are that they're not only focused on security, they also have economic and functional aspects of cooperation, which then allows people to engage in these activities without saying that we're against someone, as opposed to an alliance which by nature is against someone or something, or a particular idea or a particular country. So that power web has been happening, and the US has also been engaged in strategic partnerships, right? It has its two allies, then it has its strategic partnership with Singapore, and I know that Vietnam has the comprehensive partnership with the US, although I don't think it's at the strategic level yet. Someone can correct me or not. But you have these interlocking frameworks where which also shows you that there is a certain fear in the region about security and stability. It indicates that many ASEAN countries do not feel secure with the current environment. That in this case, it's indicative of the fact that US strategic assurances before were solidly accepted, now it is not. is under negotiation as to what assurances or to what level ASEAN can actually be assured of its security within that within this context.
The mic is coming over here.
Thank you for a very good presentation. My name is Ivan Lidarov. I'm at the Hudson Institute. My question is a follow-up to the previous questions on the TPP. Presuming that the TPP is completed and passes Congress, but not all members of ASEAN join, what do you think the effect on ASEAN would be? Does it are the members who are already in TPP, are they going to pull up the others over time to join the TPP, or do you think the others will join RCEP, or do you think there will be a similar effect? In a certain sense, what would be the effect of the partial success of TPP, especially economically also, because this would have substantial economic effects on the ASEAN as an economic community. Thank you.
That's a good question, because yeah, what happens when some members, if TPP pushes through, some members are members of the TPP, some ASEAN members are not. But then this is where ASEAN's ability to negotiate various forms of economic agreements comes in. So you have that RCEP, but within ASEAN itself and within between ASEAN and some other countries, you have a lot of economic agreements, such as to the point where you have, in fact, a noodle bowl existing in Asia. China has an ASEAN, China is negotiating an ACAFTA, right? A free trade agreement between ASEAN and China. But China is also negotiating with bilateral countries. Now, Japan has several economic partnership agreements, which are basically trade and economic agreements with several other countries. But then you have an ASEAN-Japan level. So it's really very complicated. So it's not as if the TPP is the be-all and end-all of trade. It is, but it is important because it challenges ASEAN to have a more solid, to take a more solid approach to regional economic agreements. Otherwise, you know, would the RCEP be the same as previous agreements on regional economic cooperation? So I think in that way it challenges the region to actually have some standards, and hopefully that will filter in to RCEP. But if the TPP fails, then there's the RCEP as the fallback position.
Okay, others? Okay, question here?
Yes, just adding on to the economic perspective.
Could you just identify?
Jose Collazo, Asia Rising Television. I was wondering if you can comment on the recent roadshow by the Chinese leadership throughout Southeast Asia proclaiming the Diamond Decade, how it was received within the Southeast Asian community, and their premise that security issues can be divorced from economic issues.
Yeah, well, there is this tension within Southeast Asia also between security and economics, right? In the region, it is China that is now the main economic partner, but at the same time, many, or if not most, ASEAN countries still look to the U.S. as the security guarantor or the main security partner. So in that sense, they could be divorced. But in the experience of the Philippines, we have seen China flex its economic power to affect the political or security areas of conflict. And this happened with our bananas. When suddenly at the height of the Scarborough Shoal issue, Philippine bananas were not allowed to the Chinese market. Whereas before, even saying that there were some SPS standards that were broken by the Philippine banana exporters, they allowed it to enter the Chinese market. But then during the height of that Scarborough Shoal issue, they said we won't allow it under these SPS rules, which tells you that you can only declare so much, but then it's the actions that would tell us how they're going to behave. So when the Chinese, when they did that declaration, it is welcome, of course. When the biggest economic partner in the region says that we welcome you to join us in this agreement, then everyone would say yes. But of course, everyone is also hedging their bets on other areas, especially areas of potential conflict.
There was another question there.
Yes, Dave Fitzgerald, retired Foreign Service. I'd like to go back to several of the questions that were asked and just sort of turn it around again. What is the real future role for an ASEAN that's going to be any different than what it has been in the past? It seems like the countries in ASEAN are being buffeted by all these different economic and bilateral strategic arrangements that's really undermining any sort of progress towards a more enhanced ASEAN community that actually means something other than, you know, the general notion or like a cloud of what ASEAN might mean.
Yeah.
ASEAN seems to have a sort of an out-of-body relevance, but it doesn't really matter much when it comes to a calculation of the strategic balances, the strategic policies, choices, and actions that nations in that region take.
Yeah, and I would link it to our question earlier about regional institutions. And really, I would argue that there's a fundamental need to revisit our commitments. When they agreed on the ASEAN Charter and ratified it around 2007, the problem was that, as many observers in the region pointed out, they only agreed to put on paper what they've been doing for several years. And that hasn't been really what you would call a leap of, you know, a big leap in what ASEAN has been doing. It's just, you know, the ASEAN way put in formal paper. But then, as we've seen, especially when it comes to the monitoring and implementation of these various agreements, ASEAN is very weak. And that is the, you know, that's a big argument if that's true or not. But I would argue that without a stronger secretariat who's able to monitor these various agreements, then you have a problem because the benchmarks are not very clear. What have we achieved this particular year or in this, the medium term or in the long term? But there's also the larger question of the strategic role of ASEAN. And I think this is where they are finding out that their commitment to a rule where they don't share a common foreign policy or security policy, heck, we don't even come to an agreement about what our common strategic threats are, is already a big problem. And I think at the foreign ministers level, especially and as well as the ASEAN defense ministers meeting, they've been trying to closely work together. Of course, it all depends on how national interests within member states converge also. Because really, sometimes many people feel that what's happening in the South China Sea doesn't affect states in the further west side of ASEAN. So I think at some point they have to come to an agreement on how to move about and to ensure that the Phnom Penh event does not happen again. And this is where people are watching Cambodia right now, Myanmar right now. How is Myanmar going to handle this? How is it going to make sure that there's a coherent message coming from ASEAN? Because without this institutional coherence, then major powers will really do their part to ensure that ASEAN is divided. And then member states of ASEAN will then play on their own national interests to ensure that, so, and that will weaken ASEAN. So these are very big issues, I think, that ASEAN really needs to look into, especially its policymakers.
Okay, let's see, you've got one question there, over here. Let's go there and come back to it.
Hi, my name is Constance. I'm a visiting scholar here at the Seeker Center. My question is Taiwan related. As you know, that Taiwan has been a powerhouse in the region, economic powerhouse, and has very close and robust economic relations with ASEAN countries. And however, if you look at the grouping map here, Taiwan is mostly exclusive except for the AIPAC. And my question is, can you weigh in on the possibility for Taiwan to be part of the RCEP negotiation? Thank you.
Well, not necessarily the RCEP, but let's retrace some of that events. Before, many ASEAN member states, they really did not follow a strict one China rule, right? I mean, many of them actually had some diplomatic ties at the official level with Taiwan. Then when China joined the game, especially in the ASEAN Regional Forum, things changed. Now, ASEAN was open to China to have a more active role, actually to engage with China so that it can socialize China into its norms, right? you know, non-violence, non-intervention, negotiations. But then what happened? Slowly but surely, every ASEAN member state suddenly adhered to a strong One China rule. So who socialized whom in this case is a big question that the scholars might want to look into. But then, I think in the economic front, and I think Chinese scholars could answer this more strongly than I could, China hasn't, in fact, hasn't complained that much if Taiwan engages in economic relationship with ASEAN member countries. Of course, the way to do it is not an official diplomatic level because of the One China policy, but then there's that, you know, that gray area between the official level and the unofficial level where Taiwan can come in. But joining RCEP as a member economy is a big, I think, a very big question, because RCEP is intended for what many people would consider as formal states that have been standing in the international system. I mean, like, you know, official members of the UN and all that. So at this point, I am unsure that actually Taiwan could join RCEP negotiations, but you're right, it has to be considered as well because of its economic role in the wider East Asian region.
Yeah, there were two other questions, Sean? Three. Okay, one, two, three. All right. Right there. Mike? Right.
Hi, my name is Nick Mueller, and I'm a journalist. And I was wondering, today, the Sultan of Brunei just announced that he will implement Sharia law into the country. And so I was wondering if, how ASEAN views this development, and as a leader, as the leadership of ASEAN right now, how, if any, impact that has in terms of perception or how that's being viewed by ASEAN or other actors in the region.
That news only came out today, in fact, right? And so it's really difficult at this point to see if there has been an official response. But I would guess that since this is an internal rule within Brunei, ASEAN member states would be wary of criticizing it because of non-intervention. Unless it has come to a point where human rights violations are actually being committed under that policy, I don't see ASEAN member states issuing any statement for or against that kind of policy. So it goes back to ASEAN's non-intervention rule about what happens within member states. Unless they actually have an impact on the wider region, they will not be able to comment on it.
Sean?
Observation, the question, when Kishore Mahbubani was here in 1997, on the 30th anniversary of ASEAN's founding, someone actually asked him, how does ASEAN actually hold together? And he gave a response which I thought was flip and kind of absurd in a way. He said, well, after the meetings, we actually go play golf. But it sort of got at the limited institutionalization of ASEAN, that a Secretary General would actually give such a nonsensical sort of answer. To me, what I wonder about is, instead of looking at ASEAN as a driver of integration in the area, you haven't really talked about integration from below. And there are many, many ways in which actually Southeast Asia is integrated in unfortunate ways and fortunate ways from below, from human trafficking to air travel to tourism to workers working in another country and so on and so forth. So in essence, I mean, do you really see the main driver of integration really being an economic one from below that eventually ASEAN can, in a sense, play an important role in? Or do you think that it's really an ASEAN-driven process?
Yeah, and I think that's a very good point, because this has been a complaint among many people that, you know, the problem with ASEAN integration is that it's mainly, first, it was formerly limited to the foreign ministries. Second, they started to bring in other ministries. But as you can see, it's still at the what you in the US would call the executive branch level, right? Not even involving policymakers at some point, unless something has to be ratified or some laws need to be passed. But yeah, at that level, ministries can always assure you that everything is going on schedule. But I agree, there has to be some sort of economic integration below. where people can actually claim to be a member of this, you know, a citizen of this wider community. And that falls under the ASEAN sociocultural community, especially the identity building part. What is an ASEAN identity? And we've not agreed upon what that is. I mean, there is a declaration that we have to have one identity, and the states have been coming up with many agreements, with many actions, such as having the ASEAN flag flown in various ministries or various embassies. But we have to see more effort coming from the government to actually educate the people about what ASEAN is. And you're right, sometimes we can't be, the regional leaders can be flip about it, but and the argument has been, this is a confidence building measure. But then at what point will you have actually built confidence enough to actually tackle deeper problems? And so one of the main issues that civil society people have always raised is, how do people within ASEAN participate in all of these processes? And there have been some mechanisms, there have been some interface between civil society leaders, business leaders, and the government. But I think more needs to be done. In fact, I could remember that one of the, in a meeting where I attended, one senior official remarked that, you know, if they really want integration to happen, they should just remove all labor restrictions and allow people to just go around the region and find jobs. That would, in fact, deepen integration. Like, but we haven't even come to a point where we actually recognize degrees from all countries to be able to practice professions within ASEAN. So there are a lot of things to be done. And all of these fall under the purview of what is called the ASEAN sociocultural community. Labor and migration, you know, transnational issues, health issues, and all of these that impact the people.
The haze.
So, you know, I mean, haze from Indonesia going to Singapore, and that's a very big issue because one of your most advanced economies suffer from a pollution problem not of its own making. So, and even within ASEAN, it's difficult to actually come together and find a solution to that. And people will say it should be a bilateral issue, but then the haze is not limited to Singapore alone. It moves around the region and it affects everyone else in one way or another. So, yeah, I agree with you at that level. There can only be, you know, you can only agree on so many things, but then you have to implement them. And that's where many of these issues actually arise.
Yes, last question, I think.
Donald Barnes from South China University of Technology. You've talked very eloquently, I think, about the complexity of the issues here. Are there any models, historical models, from elsewhere in the world that ASEAN might look like and say, gee, if we followed this set of development, we might move in this direction as well? Any historical models for that? The other one, that's looking backwards, and then looking forward, if we were to invite you back here in 5 years, I hope it's not that long, but if you came back here in 5 years, how would we know, what would we look for, what could you tell us that would mark success for ASEAN?
My career summed up in so many words. Now, you're right about the model issue. Are there models out there that ASEAN could look into, and, you know, and Europeans are always happy to tell us there's the EU and we'd like to teach you how to do it. And everyone's saying, you have a problem right now, you're not actually the best model. It is a model, not the model. However much our friends from Europe would say that theirs is the most, you know, viable way of regional integration. But it is a model, and ASEAN seems to want to say that we can pick and choose whatever aspects that would best fit us. But as the region has had a different historical trajectory from the rest of the world, from other regions as well, we can only build institutions that would fit what we believe would be the way that we should move forward. And as of now, it is still very much intergovernmental. I don't see any movement towards a supranational governance. It is intergovernmental, it's still decisions made at the national capitals which will matter, and in 5 years, there's not going to be that major dramatic change. I hope you still invite me in 5 years, given that.
Okay, there's no other questions, then I think one thing I can say is that ASEAN, even after 45 some years, is still a very much a work in progress. and it's with some basic fundamental issues that have still to be answered. On the other hand, it does have a certain impact and influence that is growing. So I think there's almost a sort of disconnect between the what our expectations are and what our assumptions are and what it actually is doing. So I'm not sure, perhaps you can help answer that question at some point, but please join me now in thanking Mr. Amdor for a great
thank you. Thank you so much for inviting me. And just one final point, one of the things that we'd really like to see with this rebalance is the people-to-people part. We'd like to see more Americans coming into the region because we've seen a lowering of the number of Peace Corps volunteers being assigned to the region. We've seen, you know, less people coming in, and there are many barriers to entry to the U.S. from Southeast Asia. And if you really want to move the rebalance forward, you have to take in the people, and I think that would be the final word I would say. Thank you so much.
Agreed. Thank you.
I took a picture of that one with the drawing.